first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation. Certainly a privilege to be here, and I really enjoyed my stay. Unfortunately, it's over tomorrow, so I have to go back tomorrow. Although this talk is about non-equilibrium Casimir force or fluctuation-induced force, and I should say that most of this material that I'm going to present today, I did actually hear it. I am KITP, so it is preliminary work. So the first part is finished, but it's still preliminary work. So what I'm going to talk about is essentially the system here. So what we have are two plates. These green solid lines are the two plates. And I consider the case where the lower plate, say, is at rest, and the upper plate is moving, for example, with a sinusoidal time dependence. And I consider the simplest case where we can see a non-equilibrium dynamics, which corresponds to a Langevin dynamics. Here's a Langevin equation with some friction coefficient. And we have here local correlations, temporal and spatial correlations between the noise. And this is the most simple version of a non-equilibrium system that you can imagine. Pascal has talked about a more complicated system of this sort, but the difference is here that I impose a non-equilibrium feedback of the system by this explicit time dependence of one of the plates. So the plates themselves are flat, but there is a non-trivial time dependence. So this is in a different view shown here. The time dependence is now to the right, and so this is just constant, and the upper plate has sinusoidal modulation, say. And so what phenomena can we expect? What we know, what we are used to.
Are the plates flat?
Yes, they are both flat.
And this one's just going like this? Is that
no, it's going up and down. So this is so these views are always hard to draw, so that they make it really clear. So these.
If you had a double green arrow between the dashed lines, I guess.
Okay. So these dashed lines indicate, for example, extrema positions, and it's fluctuating like that in z direction, and it's completely flat and translation invariant in parallel direction. And the distance, so L as a function of t would now be the height of the upper plate above the lower plate, and as a function of t, it could look like that. And so what can we expect? What we are used to do in essentially all investigations, or all investigations, or let's say essentially all investigation did, is that we assumed a quasi-static behavior, in that we measure the Casimir force at a specific time, say t naught, and at that time there's a certain distance, and then we assume that we measure the equilibrium Casimir force for that distance. So this corresponds to the case that, so to say, we look at a time slice where the distance happens to be like that, and then we predict the Casimir force that corresponds to this momentary distance. This is a type of quasi-static approximation, and of course it is fair to ask whether this is justified. Probably it's justified in most cases, or maybe not. And what phenomena can we expect if this type of quasi-static behavior is not valid? So if you look at this picture, and for a moment you imagine this was not the time direction, but one of the spatial, one of the parallel spatial coordinates, it looks almost like a corrugation, then you would say that this type of approximation resembles proximity force theorem, where you just take the force, so to say, at this local distance. But the difference is here, so if we switch on on sufficiently fast-moving upper plate, and if the material has some finite reaction time or response time, then what we expect is that the force that we measure at a given time t0 not only is given by the momentary distance at that time of the upper plate at that time, but somehow also probes the past of the system. So it probes the past, the history, for all times smaller than this t0, but not the future. So to say, this is a difference, or one of the differences between the case where this upper plate would be modulated in spatial direction, then it would probe, so to say, the non-trivial geometry dependence of the whole geometry. But this type of non-trivial dependence only probes the past, or the left of this blue line.
So I have a very simple question. So instead of oscillating like this, what happens if you just move it with a constant velocity towards it?
That is another time dependence. So in principle, I could consider this time dependence as well. So just the specific calculation that I did for today is that there is a sinusoidal fluctuation, but this is a fair question.
So what happens? What's the force dependence? If you just move this at a constant, I assume this is the easiest case that you can do, right?
Well, in this, it turns out that the easiest case is actually really the sinusoidal modulation. It has technical reasons. We want to go instead of time space to frequency space by Fourier transformation, and then a sinusoidal modulation, so to say, picks out specific frequencies, and the calculation becomes simpler. But the technique that I'm going to present works for any time dependence. So this is a completely fair question. So I don't know what effect, but it could be done.
Can you say something about the difference between this problem and whatever Moore was doing in the 70s, or this problem of oscillating mirror close to another mirror was kind of worked out a long time ago, at least for just vacuum scalar fields. So I'm trying to see what's the
There's no vacuum. There is a fluctuating field in between, and it has non-trivial boundary conditions. And I now look at the case that the oscillations are sufficiently fast so that we see non-equilibrium response. There have been done some work on this, so I'm not the first one who is looking at non-equilibrium behavior. Mehran has done work, Ramin Golestanian has done work on this, Pascal has worked on others, so this is not the first, but this is one specific example where I think that this that has not yet been done.
But this is not a relativistic theory. Whereas Moore was.
Yes,
Model A. We'll see in a second. Okay, but this is the question that I ask in the experiment. You have this moving plate, and then somehow there is a probe. Experimentally, we can probe the force here, and this is what we measure, and now try to make a prediction for that force that we measure at the lower plate, right at the lower plate.
Just to put this in context, so we're all comfortable with the idea of two metal plates sitting a long enough time so they're welded.
Yes, so it's like...
Other than this version where you're moving it so fast that you're essentially working against the field of that.
No, it is not that fast. So it is it's faster than the relaxation time of the system, but it's not outrageously fast so that one cannot apply a coarse-grained description anymore. So it's somewhere in between. But it's faster than the relaxation time.
Fast compared to material relaxation time, but not fast compared to...
Faster than the long-ranged correlation time.
But actually, if you take that form, you're it's like critical. Huh? So the relaxation time there. And the algebraic equation that you have written is massless.
Yes, exactly. That's what I want. So I want to have a theory that this theory is just... So the equilibrium version of this theory, I will show you in a moment, gives just the equilibrium correlation function in a massless theory. So that's the simplest massless theory. So I want to have long-range correlations.
Yeah, but we have also long-range correlations in time.
Yes. Yes. Question. So one can ask, is this relevant? Or maybe first I ask the other question, is it interesting? I think it's interesting, and Pascal has pointed out basically the reasons. So first, it is interesting because in applications, there are typically moving parts. So if you talk about electromagnetic cosmic force, even though this example is not electromagnetic cosmic force, but if we one more thing about it, there are moving parts, and like a microelectromechanical systems. So it's fair to ask what is the influence of fast moving parts on the system. The other question is the other way around. Non-equilibrium response of material is typically more less universal and more sensitive to microscopic interaction, microscopic dynamics. So probing the dynamic response or dynamic fluctuation-induced forces could be another probe to probe microscopic behavior and microscopic dynamics as well. And also, there are more handles to actually influence this fluctuation-induced force in the non-equilibrium regime than there are in the equilibrium regime.
Wait a second. Also, the dynamics is only classifications in terms of universality, universality classes. So I don't see your point about microscopic mechanics.
Yes, it is. My point is maybe more simpler than you have in mind right now. This theory, for example, leads to, in equilibrium case, to the equilibrium two-point correlation function for a critical model. This could just comes from a quadratic Hamiltonian in equilibrium. But there are other Hamiltonians that also lead to the same Hamiltonian in equilibrium. For example, the scalar field theory that is widely used, that comes from a wave equation, leads exactly to the same Casimir force in equilibrium, but has a completely different dynamics. So what I try to say, that once we look at the dynamic non-equilibrium response of the system, we are more likely to see whether we're actually dealing with, in this case, diffusive dynamics or different dynamics. Of course, this is a very simple example, but it could be interesting for a more complicated system, that which we don't know much about, to try to probe the non-equilibrium response in this way. So this is the idea. But this example is really very simple, so I admit that completely. So now it's interesting enough. Also, is it relevant? This is just a rough estimate I try to do to see what we can expect. So there is a time scale or a frequency scale that determines whether this non-equilibrium response could be observed or not. And this is a combination of this friction coefficient, the driving frequency, if we have a sinusoidal driving force, and the separation between the plates. So this is a dimensionless combination. And if this is one or larger, then we expect deviations. And now if you now go to a critical fluid that could be realized in the system, could have this Langevin dynamics, then typical value for this gamma coefficient are like 10 to 11 seconds per square meters, for example, liquid crystals. Then this omega naught, this is a typical value, is 10 to 3 hertz, and this is resonance frequency in experiments that we have seen earlier. And this length scale is about 100 nanometers. If you put this together, so then we find a number that is just one. Of course, I don't claim that now all systems are non-equilibrium, but one can see that using conservative values in order to estimate this parameter, one can see that one can really achieve cases where this non-equilibrium regime could be achieved. So it is not completely outrageous to ask for that.
I might agree with you with the dimensional analysis, but if you want to describe fluids, the kind of dynamics you are considering is really...
Yeah, of course, that is true. There are other hydrodynamics and things, but this is to show you that...
Especially the conservation law. I mean, apart from thinking about coupling to hydrodynamic modes and things like this, but the conservation law of the order parameters, I mean, the dynamics is not conserved.
Yes. I don't attempt today to really describe, say, a liquid critical behavior of a liquid crystals in contact with a wall. This is more complicated. Pascal has done this more carefully. This is more simple, more fundamental. Okay. So how is the force defined? So if you have a fluctuating field, this can be any dynamics, then we can define the stress tensor. Likely you know this already, but I point it out anyway. So stress tensor has following origin. We have some energy functional, and we do a displacement. So there are bodies immersed with some boundary conditions. Now we do a coordinate transformation that is shown here. We go from the black coordinates to the red prime coordinates. And this coordinate transformation will shift the body somehow, can also deform the bodies, but will shift and deform the bodies in general. And then we ask for the change in energy that is, comes along with this coordinate transformation. Then in, if this is a small shift, then we can write this, the first linear term gives rise to the stress tensor. And this is how it's defined. And for our very simple Hamiltonian, just this quadratic Hamiltonian, no mass, the stress tensor components are just given here. So derivatives, TLK is a stress tensor. We have derivatives DL, DK, minus 1/2. If these indices are equal, then we subtract the gradient squared. So this is very simple. So we know the stress tensor for this theorem. This is how we can define the stress at a given point R. So this is the stress at a given point R in the system. For example, we could calculate the stress tensor average gives then energy change. The force is then given by the change of the energy with respect to the shift, say, in this direction. This way we can calculate the force on this whole thing if we do this transformation. We can also calculate torques and other things in this way. So this is a general definition which we are going to use to define the force right at the surface of one of the plates, namely the lower plate. Okay. So far this is quite general, relatively simple. Now, let's go quickly, go through the dynamics. So we have Longchamper dynamics, this is our Hamiltonian. We have the Longchamper equation, so the temporal change looks like a friction term. So the temporal change is given by this generalized force plus the noise. Noise correlations are local. Then we define, or we can express the solution of this equation in terms of a propagator. And this is shown here. So this is the field at a point r at time t. This is this point to the right here. And we can obtain this field by integrating over all points, taking the noise at these points and propagate it from the primed coordinates to the unprimed endpoint. Okay, so this is the noise we propagated from the primed to the unprimed coordinates, and this is shown here, and the arrow indicates that there is a direction, so we go from the prime to the unprime coordinates, and the unprime coordinates are the ones that appear here in the field. And this propagator, you can plug it in, is given as a solution of this equation. And we have causality, which means that the noise can only influence the field at a time t if it happens at an earlier time, but not at a later time. So this gives rise to this causality condition. Okay. Now the correlation function between the fields as a function of space and time is then given just by using this representation, using the noise correlations. So it is a basic, like a product of two propagators and integrated in the intermediate point, both spatial and time. And this correlation function I denote with this wiggly line, so it correlates prime coordinates with the unprime coordinates. So this is quite simple. But because it's so nice and simple, let's stick on with it a little bit. So in unbounded bulk, this propagator, here I write explicitly this theta function to indicate that we consider that we have causality, t must be larger than t prime. We can do a complete Fourier transformation with respect to space and time, and then the propagator in this Q omega representation is very simple. And what I always find nice to see again is that this very simple function respects causality, because if you go back to the time representation and just plug it in, then you can do this omega integration by a contour integration in the complex omega plane. And just as we wanted to have, we can pick out the lower circle if t is bigger than t prime, and then we have this pole here. We get the solution that we expect. But if in the other case, if t is smaller than t prime, we have to close it in the upper plane. There's no pole, so this gives zero. So this is very nice. Here it's very simple to see that an omega representation or the omega version of this propagator has also built in the causality. It's simple to see here, but in other representations that have omega, maybe mixed representations with c coordinates and omega and so on, it's not so easy to see, but it's good to know that this is fulfilled. So we have this causality. Now let's move on. And speaking of moving, so we move on to the moving surface. The surface, so this is a very general picture. Surface is now parametrized on a base plane. X are two-dimensional vectors of the base plane, and then depends on time t. And we can draw it like this. Now to the right, we write one of the spatial coordinates of the base plane, say x, and here in red is the time. And this line here would correspond to the shape of the surface at the time t. But as we move on, the shape changes, and then we have this shape and this shape at different times. And if you consider x and t as a base plane, it looks that this, so to say, this vibrating string, in if we have just one coordinate, sweeps out a surface on this two-dimensional base plane, if it draw it in this way. So in reality, this x is two-dimensional, but this is just here, one-dimensional representation. But it is like a surface on the xt base plane that is built by sweeping out the surfaces for different times. Yes.
Can I ask one stupid question? You've got a system like that. If you open up,
yes,
need some recipe for creating initial values for the phi field in the region that you created.
What?
I didn't. So you've got some plates some distance apart.
Yes.
The distance increases.
Yes.
And you've now got a set of values of phi at certain places which exist, which didn't exist beforehand. What values do you give to those to that set of phi? There doesn't seem to be a...
I don't need to have to do this coordinate transformation. You're speaking about a stress tensor.
No. When you're vibrating your plate, you've got a plate with some fields between...
It's always filled with my field. Just the boundary condition changes.
And you move the plate and...
Yeah, but
I was asking before, who's fast, who's slow, who's pushing?
Yeah, you're asking the Cauchy problem as well defined.
Yeah.
The initial value data.
Yeah, in some sense, yes. Because you've got theta, you open up and you've got some new space, and you have to know what are the values of the field. Is that completely obvious?
I thought it was the other way, that when you go from one to the other, the fields have to adjust, and you just see which way they have to adjust
before. You can sort of define the growth of the space.
The electrons on the surface.
Okay, imagine that the field exists throughout the space, but it is zero where the surface is and above it.
So that could
and
be
as the surface is being swept, some regions that were zero when the surface is sweeping, then change from zero
okay,
to
something. Okay, so that's...
And the electrons have to move by that. That's the field that's on the
other side. Actually, this question was, I think, in the relativistic case, it rose because there is a difference if you think about it as dynamics coming from a Hamiltonian, or in this language. If it's coming from a Hamiltonian, then you run into this problem because the Hilbert space changes as you change the place of the planes. But I think here it's
you can imagine like a membrane and you have a rod which is fixing the membrane, you shift the rod.
Okay, but this is the problem now, so how it's defined.
Somehow implicit in there is what's fast and what's slow. You're making some kind of quiet assumption.
Diffusion is in some sense always fast at smaller scales. If you're just moving things epsilon, it's always the diffusion.
This is what I try to say at the beginning. So it is microscopically it is fast, but because think of critical slowing down. We have in this setup we have this length scale L, which is not small, and we're looking at the response in a system that is characterized by this large length scale L here. And think about critical slowing down. So this is a similar or related problem. So critical slowing down means if, as you approach a critical point, then the length scales, correlation length increases. And on these large length scales, the system takes a lot of time to adjust so that we have really an equilibrium configuration.
It's in the boundary condition. Because it's got that phi equals zero on the boundary. So
yes.
You're moving the boundary phi equals zero.
You can't. If you're moving fast, it's zero. Not zero where you moved it. You're moving it to where it is. And that makes the field that the charges are, to which the charges are responding.
If you go back to what Israel said about a Hamiltonian system, then changing the volume of space definitely gives you a divergent contribution to vacuum energy, quartically divergent proportional to the volume, just from the naive density of states. So you increase the Hilbert space, you create new modes, and they give a vacuum contribution. So if you were to do a relativistic scalar field between plates like this, you'd have to make some commitment to what's happening on the other side of the plates. Right. So, but I don't know enough about the way the Langevin equation differs from the Hamiltonian approach to understand whether you have that problem here.
I would suggest that we move along, and then if you see a problem in the calculation you just pointed out. So because at the end I derive a force, and then there should be an answer if it's wrong or not.
Maybe just one more, because I think it's an interesting point. If you take a European operator at some point x, and you know that the evolution is unitary, right? Then the evolution field operator would be u phi on x u dagger. But then if phi is somehow constrained at the same time to be zero, that means that All of these things, it seems that it would be zero forever if you did a unitary evolution somehow. I think that's the kind of confusing thing.
But this is not a unitary evolution.
This is not. But let's go back.
Okay, so you see, I wanted to point out here that viewing this way, the moving surface on a base plane, it has one dimension more. Now the time direction looks like, again, like a deformed surface. And we know how to treat deformed surfaces. So here, or to treat deformed surfaces and to find the propagator and correlation functions, I borrow a concept that was developed earlier for deformed surfaces that were only deformed in spatial directions, but not in time. Actually, also in time, when Meron did dynamic Casimir investigations. But so here, this slide shows you how we can calculate the full propagator in a system that is bounded by such a time-changing surface in terms of bulk propagators. And how does this work? The result is given here. I just explain you in a second how you can derive this, what the result is given here. So I claim that the correlation function in the geometry with the time-dependent surface between two points is given by the bulk correlation function minus an expression. And this expression is built the following way. We have the bulk correlation function from the point from the right, let's say from the prime coordinates, goes to a surface point, which has also its own time, tau. Then we have here a kernel that couples surface points, points on the base plane, but remember the base plane now has all the time. And to the right, we go from the surface point away again to the other coordinates of the problem. So this is, and then we integrate over all points of the surface. If we have two surfaces, we have to include both surfaces in each integration and all times also. And this kernel in the middle here, this red kernel, is the inverse of the bulk propagator and plugged in surface points. So R, remember, parameterizes the surface. So this was this picture, R xt parameterizes the surface. And xt is the base plane. And this is, on this base plane, is where the red kernel M is defined, and it's the inverse of the propagator if we confine it to the base plane.
I would have expected to see the full propagator under the, for that to be an integral equation. But is it because this is Langevin dynamics that that's
no, that is completely general. That is completely general. This works for any propagator that can be derived from a from some kind of action. So this is here, we can derive this from an action, but we can, anything that we can derive from an action, we can do it in this way. Even for the electro.
But for thermal, I mean, if you have interaction, you cannot do anything. I think. I mean, this is bounded to be quadratic theory.
But not in the presence of boundaries. I mean, if you look at the Valian block formalism, for example, the propagator in the presence of boundaries is a free propagator plus free propagator kernel.
I don't have an interacting theory here. So the interaction comes by the boundaries. So the boundaries in so the boundaries induce the non-trivial correlation function.
So but there are no paths that go from this point to the boundary.
Yes.
And then back to the another.
Yes,
boundary.
I will show you in a moment. So this is there are a lot of formulas here. So that
comment on this. It's in M. You're focusing M is the inverse of something. You, if you would expand this, you would get the multiple reflection expansion. It's basically the solution to this integral.
Oh, M's not just a surface kernel.
No, it's the inverse. So here, this is here.
Function evaluated on the surfaces.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So this is non-trivial. This M is
summations were put into the kernel.
Right, you resum the multiple reflection and get the inverse basis.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
I think Thorsten has done this even for the electromagnetic field. So one can this works for any quadratic theory.
No, this
goes also beyond quadratic theory. Quadratic theory. You need a non-interacting theory to get this.
This kind of structure, if you have interaction, you cannot introduce this kind of structure. Or you can by pseudo-.
Then you do perturbation theory, and we have done this in this paper here. You can, in this paper here, we have done it. So, what we, just to comment on your question, if you have an interacting theory, then we need the propagator of the interacting theory, but it's very hard to calculate. But we, in a Feynman expansion, we expand this also in bulk propagators. In bulk propagators, we can do like this. And then we can, on top of it, do an epsilon expansion with respect to the non-harmonic term. And this is has been carried out also in this paper. So it's possible one can combine this. But this is here, so to say, simpler. We don't have the difficulty of an interacting field theory. It's a quadratic theory, but we have the boundaries. And here's the complicated part, or the hard part, so to say, the hard part of solving the problem has been moved from solving the equation for G to finding the inverse of this this colleague here. And so then when we have achieved, and this M contains a lot of information about the surfaces. So this, let's check if this works a moment. So this looks complicated, but it's really much more, it looks more complicated than it actually is. So let's go with this R on the surface at some time t. Then this means that there is some vector u on the base plane, so that R has this representation like before. And if we plug this in, so now we plug this part in here, and then by definition of M, this just produces delta functions. And I've written these delta functions here to the right. And then the second integration can be done, and this just gives the same bulk propagator that is already here. So it subtracts just the right part, and then it vanishes. So it's very, it's built to be to work like that, but can be derived by using path integral method with constraints. Maybe one can almost guess it here for the Dirichlet case, but it works in general also for different boundary conditions, different types of boundary conditions. But it's not so obvious what the final result would look like. So this works. Now we're having seen these formulas. Look more complicated than it is. So it's really like that, as simple as that. The blue line is now the propagator in the problem with the two surfaces, alpha 1 and alpha 2. And so what I just have shown you is that this propagator corresponds to the propagator in free space without surfaces, minus something that is built like that. We go with the propagator to a surface point. From then we go with the kernel to another surface point, and then we go to the right point. This is the kernel, and both green dots need to be integrated over all surfaces. So not only, for example, this dot at some point jumps here, and this dot jumps here. So this M is actually a matrix. If we parameterize the surface integration this way, indices correspond to different surfaces. So this can be done. So far, so good. So far, so good. Remember, in the beginning, I've shown you the stress tensor, and the stress tensor is essentially given by correlation functions. So you see that here, the force is given. We need the mean value of correlation functions here. And so far, we only have the propagator. But remember also what we had earlier, that correlation function is something that looks like this. So it is, correlation function is this wiggly line here. And it's like a product of two propagators. So we can draw this also in a diagrammatic way. So this is now for correlation functions that we can calculate the stress tensor. So we have here the wiggly line is now the correlation function that we want, namely in the space with the surfaces. And we have seen before this equation is just about which I have just reminded you. So it can be as written as a product of two propagators. And this black dot is an integration over whole space. This can be done in the case with the surfaces and without surfaces. So without, I use black to indicate that we have bulk correlation functions and bulk propagator. And we have also the ingredient for this propagator derived, namely it's the bulk propagator minus something that has this M in between. Now you can just put it together. That was the most fun part of this calculation, actually, to put this together. I like doing this because there's no calculation to be done, really. So you put this together. You plug this here, and then you get four parts that look like this. Remember that black dots are integrations of a whole space. So we have first the bulk parts, then we have the square of this, this is this, and the mixed terms that we subtract, always this red part in the middle. Then, of course, you see immediately that you can integrate now over the black dot because this gives the weakly line again, like here. So we integrate it now, and then we get the representation of the correlation function as the bulk correlation function plus a part that looks like this. So we have the bulk correlation function and then these things protruding to both sides and the mixed terms. But the relevant part is we can express the correlation function from which we can calculate the force completely, even for this problem with the time dependence, with the Langevin dynamics, where the time is implicitly incorporated in the boundary condition in terms of corresponding bulk correlation functions. And we also need the propagator here and the, this red kernel. Okay, so this is...
If the correlation function happens to attach it to a boundary, does it vanish?
Yes, we can check it. For example, let's check it. So remember, this thing, this red thing is defined. If we put this here on the boundary, then it, so to say, vanishes because this is inverse. So let's do it. Here, for example, this is on the surface. So let's make a cross here, indicating it's on the surface. Then we can make a cross here, and a cross here, and a cross here. So here we have, so let's see. We make a cross here, then this vanishes. Then we have this thing, but this cancels just this thing. And
cancels, yeah.
Yeah. OK? So one can, again, for the Dirichlet boundary condition, one can almost guess it if you know the result. But it works for more complicated boundary conditions as well and different dynamics as well. So the thing is now, what we have now achieved is that even in this time-dependent problem with the changing surface, somehow we have found a representation of the solution of the Langevin equation, which the time dependence is, so to say, frozen in. It is incorporated. It would be not so easy to solve this problem trying directly to solve the differential equation. Okay, now we have both ingredients to calculate forces, and this is looks all a little bit unusual, so let's just check it if it works. Equilibrium causing the force between two plates. And here I come back to a remark that somebody made earlier. What we want to find is the equilibrium causing the force that corresponds to a scalar theory. And there should be no trace anymore that we actually started from a Langevin dynamics. This dynamic, so this information, so to say, vanishes once we go to equilibrium. And so how do we do this now? So we can put the ingredients together. This is the problem, but L is now fixed. This is the basic problem. Almost every talk picture like this appeared. So then the equilibrium force per unit area on the plate at Z equals zero. So the force on this plate is given by the average of the stress tensor component TZZ taken at some intermediate point Z naught and at a time t. But in equilibrium, this should not depend on time t and does not depend on time t. And this is one thing. For the other part, it also should not depend on this choice of Z naught. So wherever we chose, so to say, this intermediate plane on which we calculate the stress tensor to obtain the force, which, and this plane is ultimately derived by the coordinate transformation in order to derive the stress tensor, should give the same force. So this is no...
This is not this second independence geometry, or...?
It's the fact that this expression gives the force. And
yeah, but the force at the polar position is at zero. But
no, the force on the plate. So this, imagine you do a coordinate transformation in such a way that you really cut the system and move it a little bit apart, and then you create a surface along the cut, and this cut then corresponds to the surface over which we have to integrate the stress tensor. But since each coordinate transformation, each the choice of Z naught, or since the same shift of one of the plates can be achieved for different places of Z naught, it should always give the same force. So if you calculate this, the intermediate expressions look very differently for different Z naught, but if you calculate the final result,
It's the momentum per unit time flowing across a mathematical surface, which is the force.
Yeah, okay, but I mean, it means if the plate would not be parallel to
Let me put a different example.
This is a pressure, so if you want the total force, you have to integrate it.
Let me put a different, let's look at this picture again, completely general geometry, and you can imagine a coordinate transformation that shifts the red, shifts the green body to the red body. But there are many different types of coordinate transformation that can do that, even though it looks special, but there are many different types. But they should all give the same energy change. So in, so to say, if you have a lot of time and want to do this on the computer because you don't have anything else to do, you can choose different coordinate transformations, get completely different intermediate results, but the final result for the energy change and the force on this thing must be the same. And this is not a principle remark, but it is, or advantage, but it's of practical advantage because, what was the last slide? The equilibrium force, yes. Because it gives you a check of your calculations. You can just find bugs in your program with that. Maybe you don't need it, but if you have to complicated calculations, such independent and highly sensitive checks are highly welcome. So I did a similar thing like that some time ago with critical Casimir force, and there it was really useful that we had this check in order to make sure that we calculate the right thing. Okay, now we can choose, because this works for any Z naught, we can in particular let Z naught go to zero, and then this stress tensor average assumes an even simpler form, is just the z derivatives of the fields taken at the lower surface.
Apart from divergences that you can get when doing point splitting like this.
No, there is no divergence. The stress tensor is finite. There's another nice property of the stress tensor.
There's point splitting. Well, I mean, I agree on the right hand side, on the left hand side, when you write it like the right hand side. Then, no, when you define the stress tensor by a point splitting, usually you have to subtract divergence to make it fine. So probably in this case you don't need it, but I did something similar. In my case, I had to consider it.
Yeah, this notation is a little bit sloppy, so I should it's not sloppy. It's Z naught. It's defined like that. It's because at the end the stress tensor depends only on one spatial coordinate. So you have to do this. You take, of course, if you build the derivatives, you have to keep track of the primes. So once you're finished, you let.
Regularization, if you want. This is a way of.
Okay, but let's discuss this later. But here there was no problem. Okay, now we have this. And now let's see. We can continue here. Yeah, so what we need is obviously the correlation function here. And now we just do really this machinery that we had before. In a way, considering the dynamic theory, so the weakly line is the correlation function that has the time dependence. And now we go to Now, in this particular problem, we go to a presentation where we do partial Fourier transforms, namely with respect to the lateral coordinates. So this is this R parallel, and with respect to time, which is also translation invariant in this problem because there's no time dependence. And then you can also find the corresponding piece. The bulk propagator now has this form, so a little bit more complicated, 1 over 2 q. Q is the square root of an inverse complex number, p squared minus I gamma omega. And here's exponent minus q difference and z and z prime. So we have pz representation means that we have z explicitly, because that's the place where we want to impose the boundary conditions. So that's natural. Then g star is the other direction, with omega replaced by minus omega, corresponds to the complex conjugate. And the correlation function finally corresponds then to a product of these functions, but integrated over xi, and then you can do that. And this gives an expression that can be worked out, and the result looks like this. So remember, this q has frequency and p in it. And once so this is the way how it was calculated. So this is the correlation function that we want. This is the bulk correlation function, then various parts, like we have seen before. Yeah, and then we put this together. And at the end, we need to do it at equal times. This leads to an integration over omega. In omega representation, we need to integrate all of the parallel coordinates, shrink to one point, we need to integrate over all momenta. Then we take our correlation function and derivatives thereof. And this gives rise to two contributions. One part is divergent, and this corresponds to something that you find if you have no two plates but only one single plate. So there is a divergent contribution of the force that does not depend on L, but which is there. And then there's an L-dependent part, which is finite. And you can do this by contour integration in omega, like before. Then the result you can do even exactly over p. And then you get the result that you expect from a quadratic field theory. And there's no gamma anymore. And again, I point out again, this result is more universal than the theory where we started from. So we started from a specific dynamics, Longchamp dynamics in this case, where we get the expected result. But this result could also be derived for a different Hamiltonian, quadratic Hamiltonian, with, for example, for the scalar electromagnetic field.
So Q is defined with gamma, right?
Yes. Yes, but if you do this contour integration, then it just simplifies so that this gamma cancels. We canceled already. We canceled already before going here. We canceled on the previous transparency.
So the divergent part that you've got labeled there, that's the bulk correlation function?
This here?
Yeah.
No, that's a surface contribution. That's a surface.
That would be even
force.
If you have infinite separation, right? I
mean, yeah, it gives this force. So
that's
the flux.
So the statement that there was no divergence, the question that was asked was, did you get a divergence?
Was this your question?
Yes.
Actually, yes.
Sorry.
You said that the expectation value of the stress tensor is finite. I mean, you have to make it finite.
You make it finite. It's
if you don't make it finite, at the end you find divergences, and you found them. Here it's easy because you can disentangle them. The argument that they do not depend on the geometry. So
right.
You know that they are there, and you are not interested in them.
There was a question about the Q. The Q depends on gamma.
Yeah.
Yeah. The correlation function, then, this gamma, there's a prefactor here has this gamma. Correlation function gives the force, has a gamma KVT. This cancels this gamma, but Q still has the gamma. But if you do the contour integration, maybe I should include this line, but the transparency was full, then it drops out. So you can trust me.
What's the least scale omega to gamma omega and the integral doesn't change, so clearly.
It's because in that, there's an omega downstairs.
Okay, so that's good to know that the whole machinery works, and it, of course you know that, but we derived this from a theory at the time, depends already incorporated. Now we can just do corresponding changes to investigate, to study the case of a moving plate. So this is done here. Now we have the upper plate is moving. L now depends on T. You can write this like, again, over the base plane, you have now this T dependence. And the same procedure applies as before. We have these graphs, but remember the green dots were integrals over the surface. Now this surface is not, these integrals over the surface cannot be done in omega space just by multiplying omega functions, but we really have to take this time dependence of the surface here. So then you go back to space where you have explicit time, write down the integral carefully with all the time dependence, and do a first order expansion in the height profile. So the height profile is now given by this cosine dependence. We have a small a. We consider only results or contributions to first order in a here analytically. You could do this numerically if you are able to invert this kernel m, but here we do a first order expansion in a. And if we do that, then so we go to time, keep track of the time dependence here, and then the final, then the expressions that remain after this has been expanded can be re-expressed in omega space, but then you find contributions that pick out just frequencies omega naught and minus omega naught from the moving plate here. So I don't want to show you all these integrals, but I think you understand what I mean. We have here now this time dependency, and this can be taken care of. And in Fourier space, we pick out corresponding frequencies. So that's not too surprising. And now, so what? How's the force defined was the question earlier. Now we, now this stress tensor here is not no longer independent of the spatial position here between the plates. But what we do, we really go, we want to measure the force on the lower plate at a time t. And this is given by this local average here at a point r close to the surface at time t. So this now depends on t. It's not independent of t. But it's the local. So this brackets here is a local average. So we here, this comes back to your earlier question. So we still assume that we are not outrageously perturbing the system so that we cannot find define an average like this anymore. So here locally, we can still do an average like this in order to calculate the stress tensor average, but we cannot do this globally anymore. So there's a separation of length scales. So very close, you have a small cell. We can still do this this averaging, but this now depends on time t.
And this one is going also to depend on space. This stress tensor, because you have no longer the requirement that the second shape quantity now.
But not on this. This direction. This is.
This is simulated, but
in
this direction.
No, this not. But like I said, this now must be done like this. One must now, in the slide that I had before, I said we can calculate the force, and we just choose out of convenience. This is equilibrium. We choose out of convenience to go to naught because then the stress tensor is a little bit simpler. But we don't need to do that. We can do this in any plane and we get always the same result.
Yeah, but now the physics is that your stress is in the system that depends on the position of your system.
Yeah, exactly. Now, so we are completely agree. So now this is no longer possible. Now you have to do it really at the surface.
You want to measure the stress at the surface.
Yeah, exactly. Not so we cannot, if we take this thing here, or the stress tensor has not just C derivatives, but the stress tensor at a different Z, then we get a different result. But we have to do it at the surface. Then we have still this expression here. And now you believe me, we have done this calculation. So the correlation function is expanded in terms of these graphs now. Now we have also an expansion in terms of this small a here. So we have this different graphs for different graphs, and each graph decomposes in contributions where we pick out the surface integration and this t dependence. And then we have this.
Can you also compute the force in the upper plot? I mean, is there an interesting correlation, like some pulling and pushing?
Yeah, I have not done that yet. So
maybe at the end I tell you I've done something similar to these. Actually, I mean, you find cases in which, for example, if you have pretty normal mountain conditions, the equilibrium of chords, because it's equilibrium, you have this exactly the same force on the Dirichlet wall and on the normal wall. But when you do non equilibrium dynamics, it might happen that in some regimes, the force on the Dirichlet wall and the normal wall, they are different. So in principle, you have a dynamic way of discriminating which one of the two worlds is Dirichlet, which one is not.
Yeah, sure. So that's why I was asking if there is like a, you know, an overall like kind of a pulling, pushing.
Yeah, there has been. But there is nothing strange because at the end you have a medium in which it was true. So.
Okay, so now I show you the result. This is the last but one slide. So the upper three lines are to remind you this is now the time dependence of the plate, has this omega naught frequency. Then the first order in A, we have the time dependent force. So there's a prefactor, this is a time independent force for L naught, so the medium position. This one corresponds to the zeroth order in A, and this is the first order in A contribution. So it has a factor A over L naught. And this 3 comes from expanding. And this function f now depends on, is dimensionless and depends on the combination omega naught t. And on this capital omega, remember before this was the parameter that determines how far we are away from equilibrium or not. Okay? And so this function now is plotted here. And so it has this cosine dependence, the same cosine dependence as the driving force, but so there are two things. There are an amplitude that depends on this parameter capital omega and a phase that translates to a time lag tau that is given here.
How do you calculate the time lag?
I do this integration. So from the previous slide, this integral, it picks out frequencies omega naught and minus omega naught. And if you put different graph contributions together, then you just find that, yeah, it is not cosine, but cosine with a phase. So it comes out of the calculation.
So, but you have to do it numerically?
No, it is contour integration. Everything is contour integration. It picks out these frequencies. And then numerically, the momentum integration is numerically, with mathematical.
And I mean,
simply the fact that perturbations propagate. Huh? No, that tau is clear for me. It's just the value of tau.
Yeah, it is essentially numerical with Mathematica. So it is a, it's a contour integration that can be done analytically.
Does tau depend on omega or not?
Yes, it is here. So, so there are two contributions. It is this amplitude, and this how it's normalized here should. So that's also a check. Start with 1, and then goes down. So if we increasing omega means making faster and faster that we go away from equilibrium, and then this amplitude that appears here goes down, with respect to the case where this is quasi-static, and the phase is given, or this lag time tau depends also, but not very much on omega, but it depends. So this is shown here.
What's going to happen for a very large order? So which are the asymptotics of this function?
No, this goes further, but then this Mathematica cannot deal with complex numbers anymore, and then there are somehow jumps. But so this is.
But probably analytically you can get the asymptotics
now. Oh yeah, probably, yeah. I can do that. That's true. I haven't done that yet.
But tau is negative? Or do you mean a plus sign in the upper formula?
Or maybe this is wrong. Maybe I wrote it wrong. but it, no, it lacks. It definitely lacks. No.
So maybe it's when you have the.
No, I put this wrong.
Okay.
Sorry, it lacks. So it was, I found negative.
Yeah, was the physics not, if omega is big, you, let me see, what was it? You get to the to a regime where you expect this non-equilibrium behavior, or was it just?
Yes. So if I go to the right, then I expect non-equilibrium behavior.
But if you make r omega small, as it happens to be, then, all, when you're back to a static force, isn't it?
No, then here this means static. Then R omega is 1. So static means here.
No, I don't understand. Now I'm completely confused. No, I'm looking at the force equation up there.
There's a large f and a small f.
If you make the second term in a bracket 0, what happens if R omega goes to 0? Then Ft is equal to
but
0.
No, but I have still. So if this is very small, then. This is moving like very small. So, but L naught stays there. L naught is always L naught is always so this here. Let's make this very small. Then L naught is here, and this is very small. But it reduces the distance. So I cannot expect this term here corresponds to if you just expand the result in static result to first order in A.
Probably his point is if you take omega 0 equal to 0, that is capital omega equal to 0, you see the L of t is L0 plus a. So you don't recover f0 by 0, but this correction.
That's a first order correction because we do an expansion for small a.
Okay.
Because, I mean, he has chosen such a way that, I mean.
Okay, if t is equal to 0, at 0 is L. Is it 0 plus a?
Yeah, and so the force is true.
So you start with cosine. Okay.
Yes. That's why
you have started with sine, it would have been much more logical.
Yeah, but then, yeah, okay.
Can you, well, okay, yeah.
And this is the, so the sign is wrong?
In a sense, it's right. I mean, maybe you should think about not putting out of the square bracket f0 of L0, but f0 of L0 plus
a,
which is what you have when your frequency is 0.
Okay.
Because otherwise you are mixing the expansion.
Okay, good. Now I understand at least.
Yeah, and this is the lag time, so it really lags. And so I make a picture here that I have in mind. So it really looks like that. So remember, we calculate the force here on the lower plate. It looks like that there's something propagating from the upper plate, which is moving to the lower plate with some finite speed. So these are supposed to be wave fronts, and they get weaker. Then somehow this is this function, but this corresponds to waves, and they transport, so to say, the force. So the force, it makes a movement here, arrives certain wave fronts later here. But remember, this is supposed to be a fluctuation-induced force. And I found this interesting, that a fluctuation-induced force is something that we typically conceive as something that is, so to say, instantaneously there, because we calculate the energy of a configuration. Then we make a virtual shift of one plate, and then we calculate this new energy, and then we subtract this. This is something that, so to say, corresponds to an interaction between faraway bodies. But now we have something that where the medium transports the force. So just like, for example, the electromagnetic field transports the force from one faraway object to me, and only then I can measure the force on the particle, as opposed to a theory where, like an 19th century, where people looked only at the faraway interactions themselves and didn't understand that they're mediated by something that has its own dynamics. So this gives me rise to my outlook of this problem. So there were many questions that were all totally fair, but these are the questions that I had in mind. So what we found here is something that we are not used to. Now we have not really used to, as we have now considered the dynamic behavior of this force, which is supposed to be a fluctuation-induced force. But it appears here as something that is transported by a field that somehow travels from one place to the next and only has its own dynamics and then produces a force at the far away point, like the electric field as opposed to a far are they action theory? And then one can ask, what is this field, this force field that transports the fluctuation-induced force? Does this actually make sense, this notion? And if it makes sense, what are the field equations? Then the second question is that I always have in mind is the true origin of the electromagnetic Casimir force. I said at the beginning, if you look at the dynamic response of a system, we have a more sensitive probe to the the interactions, and you know of this the fact that you can express the electromagnetic Casimir force as a fluctuation-induced force by vacuum fluctuations on one hand, or by a source theory where you have only fluctuating dipoles and completely empty vacuum. So what I had in mind here, maybe somehow it is possible to look at the dynamics of this force, and that can shed light on this, whether this ambiguity is really by nature something that is only can we make up in our own interpretation, or if there's a true truth that we can maybe find out if we look at the dynamics.
Well.
So that's it.
Ask a question. I mean, just taking the analogy.